Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And it's Mind Food Radio. Hi, Michael. You've been jet-setting all over the place.
I have. And can I say, I've just arrived at the studio. Yeah. Your garden is looking beautiful. Those roses up around...
Unbelievable, aren't they?
Are they real? Or
they are real.
Are they plastic?
No, they're not plastic. They wilt in the heat out there.
How beautiful are they?
Yeah. It's good. A French rose, a climbing rose.
How much do you love this time of the year?
I do. Apart from sinus problems and allergies, we should do a segment on allergies. Have you got any?
We've done loads. I tell you what, my kids have. They've all come back from school scratching their eyes. Saying, you know, how bad is it there?
Now, you've been all over the place. Did you have a nice time?
I've been to Abu Dhabi. I've never been there before. Absolutely amazing. The Middle East is an extraordinary place to visit.
Fantastic. Now, coming up on today's show, lots of great interviews lined up for you. And, of course, if you've missed anything we've done on the show, jump onto mindfood.com and all the information sitting there.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Into the world of art.
I know, and we do lots of different interviews with artists. And in fact, on our app at the moment, we have an interview with Neil Fraser. He's a New Zealand artist, but has lived here for many years. And he travels around the country, in fact, all around the globe, and he does the most extraordinary landscapes. They really are extraordinary. And this week, he actually launches his new exhibition at the Martin Brown Contemporary Gallery here in Sydney.
Oh, yeah, cool.
So I'd like to welcome to the show Neil Fraser. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Mike.
How are you? Although it's Fraser, isn't it?
It is Fraser.
Sorry about that. Now, tell us, what can we expect in this show?
Well, this show is a series of paintings based on coastal trips that I've done, mostly out in boats in the sea, and looking at cliffs, looking at the rugged coastline of both New Zealand and Australia.
Now, I've followed your work for some years. In fact, you know, I've got to come clean. I own a couple of yours, and they seem to get bigger as the years have gone on. Are you aware of that, or that's just how it sort of happened?
As I've become an abstract painter for something like 15 years, and in the last 6 or 7 years, I've headed down a more figurative track. And as I've got more kind of comfortable with doing figurative painting, I guess I've allowed myself to kind of stretch out a little bit further and engage with a bigger canvas.
They almost dwarf, though, the viewer. You know, I've noticed, you know, when you're standing viewing your work, you know, particularly with the seascapes, you know, the water really looks like it's sort of coming at you, but the cliff faces themselves are really imposing. Do you yourself feel that when you're out in the landscape?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, very much it's a case of your relationship with the landscape and in some sense being kind of dwarfed by it. Mm. I mean, you want to feel that and you want to feel the strength and the energy of the place and try and translate that into painting. It's that energy as much as anything that interests me.
Yeah.
Is painting an escape for you?
Yes, certainly it is. in terms of, there's an element of painting that for me is kind of a play, and I love that. Obviously, it's not always a good play. Sometimes it can be, really difficult. Mm. But
do you ever switch off? Is it the sort of job that you just can't switch off? You know, you've kind of
always thinking.
You've kind of got the next painting in your head ready to go for the next time.
There's no real rest for painters. I think there's no kind of a holiday away from it. It's kind of the last thing you think about at night, and the first thing you wake up thinking about in the morning.
And tell me, do you know when to stop? Because I often think, you know, how does an artist actually know? Yes, that's completed. I'm happy with that. I'm not going near it again.
For me, it's different because a lot of the paintings I do, I end up destroying. So I'll kind of reach a point and I think, well, that's as much as I can give it, and give it a little bit of time, and then maybe a week or so later, I'll decide to unstretch it.
Wow.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Do you paint over, or do you just, that's that, it's gone?
Well, you know, they're on those wooden stretches, so at that point, I take the canvas off and slash it and put it in the rubbish and restretch.
To date, what would be your favourite piece that you've done?
That's a good point.
One on Michael's walls, lovely. Actually, it was so big, as a matter of fact, I now understand, because he had a surfboard sitting there and he said, you see, you're part of the sea band.
In the new show, I've got some really big ones, and I'm hoping that they'll look good on the wall. We're just putting them up today, and I guess the level of engagement with those really big ones.
Do you think, as an artist, though, Fraser, will you ever create a painting that you will be 100% happy with?
Maybe give me a 20-year looking back, I might be happy with them in that way. But at present, no, because I look at them and there are aspects that I like, but of course I'll see things I think that I could have done better or changed or but hopefully, you know, I mean...
Well, look, great to have you on the show. And for more details, go to mindfood.com. And also, as I said at the start of the interview, we've got an interview and a range of Fraser's work on our brand new app. If you go to the Apple Store, you can buy it. Thanks a lot, Fraser.
Thanks very much.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Yeah, film festivals are popping up everywhere of late.
And don't you love a good film?
I do.
I watch a lot on airplanes. It seems to be my new cinema.
Well, you...
However, I love, you know, like when there is a really good film festival that comes through town or you're somewhere and they've got them.
Amazing. Brisbane's got one coming up.
Tell me more about it.
We've got Richard Moore on the phone. How are you, Richard?
That was a good segue.
Thank you.
Look, you know, we're professionals.
Now, you're the festival director at the Brisbane International Film Festival. Tell me, it's about to start and it runs till the 25th of November. What can we expect?
Sex, drugs and pasta.
Interesting.
Yeah. The pasta is a reference to a wonderful tribute to spaghetti westerns. Westerns that were made in Italy and Spain when they saw that there was a market for them with great actors. Like, you know, of course, Clint Eastwood and Franco Nero, Charles Bronson... Burt Reynolds, as you know, like the...
Oh, yeah, good old Burt.
Giving the Indian perspective, so the Indians actually get a, you know, a view. And the sex is a sort of section on, which we call forbidden pleasures, on all sorts of aberrant forms of sexual human behaviour. And, hey, besides sex sells, and particularly in film festivals. And what was the other one? Sex? Drugs. Oh, drugs. Yeah, drugs as well.
Are you making this up, Richard?
How did you forget that?
We like to have fun up in Brisbane. You know, like all your film festivals down south. I used to run the Melbourne one. I know what it's like, Melbourne, you know, and Sydney. You're all a bit conservative. Up here in Brizzy, we're allowed to be a bit more imaginative, a bit more colourful, a bit more zany, a bit more experimental. And we like to have fun, and we know that movies are about entertainment.
So when you're organising an event like this, how do you get the content to be able to play it? Like, how do you source all that stuff, and where do you get it from?
I have a tragic job of travelling the world to go to film festivals for about 3 or 4 months a year.
Wow.
I reckon I watched, you know, as well as the movies on planes, I like watching movies on planes too. I must have watched about, I counted them up the other day, about 700 films last year.
Oh, wow.
Which is insane, and my eyes are bleeding at the moment. But
I imagine, though, it would be more prolific than, say, what Hollywood produces. Like, in terms of the content available, it must be just endless.
It is huge, and I just can't tell you how tragic it is. Sometimes you just feel it's great. You know, really good films have been made wherever, from Lithuania to, you know, the North Pole, and so many of those films, they just don't ever get seen because, you know, distribution, what we get shown, I forget how many it is get shown in Australia every year, but about 5 releases every week of the year in Australia, so 250 to 300 new films in Australia every year, but
that's
there's
phenomenal.
Thousands out there, thousands.
Yeah. So how many films are going to be in the International Film Festival?
100, including the short films, about 166.
God, that's a lot. So how does it work? Do people buy films individually or can they buy a group ticket that gets them a whole lot? How does it actually work?
Yeah, you can buy, go to our website, which is, it's great this year. We've already designed a new calendar and it looks beautiful and all that stuff. www.biff.com.au. And you can buy passes like Take 6, Take 12, Take 25, Take 50. We give you free sessions if you buy a pass, so you can go, you know, during the week. We'll give you a free day session to encourage people to go during the day. All sorts of, you know, all sorts of discounts, concessions.
Brisbane's going off.
It is, really.
Brisbane is happening.
I know.
Now, why should people get behind these types of festivals? Is it a certain type that goes along? Because I imagine some of the mainstream people hear about it, but they never risk to go. Why should they go?
It's not just a film festival for people who wear black shirts or black skivvies like they do in Melbourne.
I'm out.
Michael turned up in one today.
we'll let you in as well. And we have the commercial fair as well, because we know that a lot of people, and we've got some big titles, you know, in the festival this year, like big commercial titles.
Okay.
And you know, we're opening with the Sweeney tomorrow night, and we're closing with the new version of Anna Karenina by Joe Wright, which is going to be huge with Keira Knightley and stuff. And you need those titles, and people want to come and see those films because they want to, it's sort of a dinner party factor, I think. They want to see the films first.
Richard, thanks for joining us today on the program.
Pleasure.
And talking about the Brisbane International Film Festival.
Thanks, guys.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Kinesiology, interesting term, and coaching. How does that all work?
Well, we've had Therese on the show before, and of course, you know, she had me standing up and putting my arm out, and you loved it far too much.
I did. His arm's still standing out, actually.
So I'd like to welcome back to the show, Therese Mudre. Hi, Therese.
Hi, guys. Great to be back.
Oh, thank you. Now, this could be a little out there for some of our listeners, but I'm gonna talk them through it. So the wood element in Chinese medicine is represented in the season of spring. Is that correct?
That's correct. So most people are aware, Michael, of the yin-yang symbol.
Yes.
You know, the black and white symbol?
Yes, yes.
So they call that the reservoirs of all the meridian systems. And then those two, the yin and the yang, which is the feminine masculine energy, feeds into the other five elements, of which wood is one. So we've got fire, earth, metal, water, and wood.
Right. Okay.
And each represents a season.
And so with wood, is it all about sort of new growth and this, you know, spring and things like that? Is that where that sort of comes from?
Yeah, part of it is that. So if you look at the colour green, which is the wood element, what does that represent to you? So everything has, for lack of a better word, a positive and a negative. So if you think of the colour green, you can think stagnant and putrid. Mm. But you can also think new growth and new life. So a good way of looking at it is in springtime, and we use it in analogies in everyday life all the time, is, you know, like have a spring clean.
Mm.
What do you need to clean out? What do you need to get rid of? And interestingly enough, if you look at the element of wood in Chinese medicine, the gallbladder and the liver are the two organs that sit in that element. And I don't know if you know anything about what they do in the body, but they basically help and cleaning out the rubbish in our system, detoxifying all those things.
Mm. So this time of the year, what should we be doing then?
Well, as I say, have a good spring clean. Look at it, a good thing is to look at what is it in your life that you need to clean out or let go of or refresh. It's also thinking about seasons, because the next season we go into is summer. And in Chinese medicine, there's two stages to that. There's early summer and late summer. And late summer is when we harvest or reap all the rewards of the seeds that we plant in springtime.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what are you seeds do you need to plant right now to harvest later in life?
Are you talking psychological stuff as well, or what we're eating, or is it a combination of everything?
All of it. Well, you think about exercising, right?
Yeah.
You may want to get your body ready for summer.
Yeah.
But if you wait until it's time to put on a bikini, you don't want to be waiting until summer season starts. You want to plant the seeds of your healthy diet and your exercise plan, as well as your positive mental attitude now, to be able to reap the rewards later on when summer hits.
So it's really all about the balance and energy, isn't it, of your body? But it's more a holistic thing. Is that right?
Probably one of the most holistic modalities you can get. And you hit the nail on the head there, Michael, when you said balance. Because if you think of all the seasons throughout the year, we don't want to live in autumn all the time or winter all the time.
Mm.
We don't want to live in summer all the time. It's finding that balance going through the seasons. And the moment you get stuck in an element or a season, the flow isn't happening.
Mm.
And, for example, each one of the elements represents a different part of our body. So the metal element represents skin. The wood element that we're in is all about the eyes and tendons.
Mm. I think it's all important stuff, Therese. We're going to have to come back and talk about it another time. I mean, Christmas is around the corner. You can do a kinesiology clean out for Christmas for us.
I'll do it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's another whole conversation.
It is another whole conversation. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Okay, guys. Bye.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome to the show now Peter Bora from the Peninsula Hotel in Hong Kong. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Now, what's your job there? It's a very big title, isn't it?
I'm the Chief Operating Officer, but, you know, titles are not to be taken too seriously.
Now, tell me, are you involved just with the Peninsula Hotel in Hong Kong or right across the group?
Right across the group.
Okay, and now the group has grown a lot in the last few years, hasn't it, with the launch into definitely the Chinese market?
We built a hotel in Shanghai in recent years, which we opened 2 years ago. And before that, we opened our hotel in Japan, the Peninsula Tokyo. And we continue to look at further expansion. And our next one will open in Paris by the end of next year.
And how's Paris going? Because I understand it's a heritage building. Is that correct?
It is. It's a very beautiful building which opened in 1905
wow.
as a hotel called Le Majestique. And has a very rich history. Like, for example, George Gershwin wrote An American in Paris while staying there.
Oh, wow.
And after the Second World War, it became a conference center run by UNESCO. And Dr. Henry Kissinger signed the Vietnam Peace Agreement in there.
Gosh.
So there's a lot of significant moments that took place in that building.
Yeah.
And now we've gutted it, and we're building a full peninsula into this beautiful facade, and it will open hopefully by December 2013.
Where do you start with a project like that?
Well, you in an existing building like this one was, you really go inside the building and you try to feel whether you can still, you know, feel the old hotel, and we were very lucky. In Paris, we have a beautiful lobby which we will be renovating to its former splendor, and when I walked in there for the first time, you could almost hear the music play. And then it's actually quite easy to go from there and you know, reconfigure the rest of the hotel and say, this is where the guest rooms go, this is where the other restaurants will go, this is where the spa and the pool will go, conference rooms, etc. And the Paris hotel will have some very unique aspects. For example, a beautiful roof terrace, which gives you an uninterrupted view over all the key monuments of Paris, from Sacré-Cœur to Notre-Dame to the Eiffel Tower, while you can dine al fresco, which is going to be quite unique.
And Peter, had you been looking for a while for the right building to come along?
Yes, we have. We're a company that we are not just managers, we're also usually financially involved in all the hotels we do. And so we have a list of cities that we would like to expand into, and Paris was very high on that list. So for many years, we've looked at various opportunities and finally found this one, which we all like.
Now, the paperless rooms or suites in the New Look Peninsula are absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, I have been fortunate to stay at the Peninsula for some time across the last few years. And it really is visually a real departure from what they look and felt like.
So far, the response has been very good. Our guests are happy and they are able to enjoy the new in-room electronics, which, like you say, make the room paperless, which we're very happy about.
It is a brave move, though, and I know we're, you know, in media we're all moving, you know, we've got our own app and there are many different sort of digital platforms to Mind Food, but it's a brave, I think, hotel operator to be one of the first to actually have that bedside, you know, it's like an iPad where you kind of swipe everything and you can order anything, and isn't it to rather, you know, what most hotels are perhaps going back to quite traditional forms in terms of service.
Well, the Peninsula, it's part of our DNA to innovate, and in its long history, we were the first hotel with page boys, the first hotel with a fleet of Rolls Royces. I believe we're still the first hotel right now with a fully functioning helipad with its own helicopter. So all these things are part of our culture and heritage, and hence to have the most integrated in-room technology, which is, again, all developed in-house, is just part of this tradition.
As our headline says in the story, you know, the future has arrived. So congratulations to you and the team. It's a real credit to you.
Thank you so very much for your kind comments, which I very much appreciate.
It's Mind Food Radio, and you're with Ben and Michael today. World AIDS Day, not too far away.
That's right, December 1, and I always remember that because it was my old boss's birthday, same day.
We've got Michael Bedorick on the line from ACON to tell us all about World AIDS Day. How are you, Michael?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, Michael, would I be naive in thinking that AIDS is on the decrease because we don't hear a lot about it in the media today?
Not exactly. There has been an increase over the last 12 months of diagnosis new diagnoses of HIV, and it has been increasing over the last 10 years as well. The effect of living with HIV is much different, though, and there's better medicines and better treatments in place, and so living with HIV is much more of a chronic manageable illness these days than obviously the kind of health problem or even death sentence that it was at the beginning of the epidemic. But it's still a major health issue in Australia, and particularly in you know, kind of other countries throughout the world.
What demographic do we talk about in Australia when we talk about this?
Mostly, it's kind of gay men is around about 80% of new diagnoses involve gay men. And in that age group, it's mostly late 20s through to early 40s.
It's quite scary when you think about it, isn't it?
It depends on your perspective. Obviously, being diagnosed with HIV is a major issue for anyone because it is a life-changing event. But as I said, with new treatments these days, it's a much different kind of experience. However, there's still around about 30% of people living with HIV who live below the poverty line. And for them, it's a big issue because living with HIV has a whole range of health impacts. And if you are socially and financially disadvantaged, then that obviously has an effect on you being able to maintain good health. And that's one of the big things that we do with our Red Ribbon Appeal every year around World AIDS Day. We raise money for services for people living with HIV that goes towards helping disadvantaged people living with the virus.
Mm.
And that appeal runs throughout Australia. In New South Wales, we'll be selling ribbons in the and ribbon merchandise right throughout the Sydney CBD and in selected suburban areas, and also at various regional locations throughout New South Wales. I understand that also there's a range of activities, similar activities will be happening in other states in Australia.
And I suppose too there'd have to be a lot of support for the families once they find out that a loved one has succumbed to this illness. You know, you must play a vital role in that as well.
That's correct. It's not just people who are living with HIV that we support, but it's their carers, their family, their friends. We provide a whole range of support services that help all these people. Respite care, counselling, treatments advice. We provide workshops and a whole range of, you know, kind of health promotion services that support everybody who gets affected by the virus.
And what about a cure? How far away do you think that is?
Oh, that's some way. That is a way away. That's unfortunately, there's still a long way to go before there's any kind of vaccine. But we are entering what many people are calling a new era in HIV prevention, which many people are calling the prevention revolution. That's because we have improvements in medicines and testing technologies, and there is hope that if there is enough investment of resources and efforts and also inspiration from people here in Australia, that in about 10 years we might be able to see the end of HIV.
Well, Michael, you're doing a great job there. So World AIDS Day is coming up in December, and how can people get behind and help donate?
They can make a donation, and they can do that by buying Red Ribbon merchandise on the street, or they can make a donation online, which is redribbonday.org.au on the website. And on that website, they can also volunteer to sell red ribbons on the street or on World AIDS Day or the day before World AIDS Day, or they can register to take a merchandise box to sell to sell ribbons to their customers and colleagues in their businesses or their companies.
Fantastic.
Or they can go to a memorial event, and all those details are on the redribbonday.org website.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Do you like Christmas?
Love it.
And yeah,
of course,
I do too.
This issue, we've got the beautiful Jennifer Garner on, which I think is probably our most Christmassy-looking cover we've ever done. And then if you flip it over, you have an amazing Christmas cookbook.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So on the show today, we've got our food director, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, I know it was probably about April or May you started planning the Christmas cookbook. Is that right?
It was. I was thinking for Christmas all year, but yes, definitely April, May, and we shot it in August, so it's a little cold and raining outside, but we're really focused on summer and being outside and beautiful new recipes for people who are willing to try them. So, and we also thought this year we'd talk about some different cuisines from around the world. So we've really sort of changed our Christmas food a little bit this year, but I think people are going to love it. They need to get out there and buy the issue. It is absolutely beautiful. I'm very proud of the food we've done.
So it's a little bit different this year in that you've broken it down into different menus. You know, there's the beautiful baking section as well. But tell us a bit about the four different menus.
We've got an Aussie Christmas for you, and which is traditional Australian fare, which is absolutely at a New Zealand accord. We've got some poached stone fruit in there and a lovely, beautiful roast lamb. And then we've taken it on through to an Asian banquet. You know, we all like to get together and celebrate Christmas, so this is a feast serving aid. And then we've also got a southern style food, which is, you've got your spicy taste in there and a bit of bourbon. And then we're moving on through to a Pacific Christmas.
Ben's got very excited about the mention of bourbon.
I love bourbon.
You do?
Now that, in small doses.
Now, I've got to tell you, that recipe looks absolutely amazing. The pie, what is it? That looks great.
That's a s'mores pie. That's a whiskey pie, Michael. That is beautiful. And do you know what?
Oh, my goodness.
It's three different, put it together, it's three different layers. But it's just a grill under the oven. So if the day's turned out really, really hot, this is the perfect dish to make. And also it can be made in advance. And I made it just the other day, and the kids love it, although it's got a little bit of whiskey in there. But you can take that out if you need to.
They slept soundly that night.
And they didn't drive. No driving if you've been drinking that whiskey small pie. Even the whiskey small pie.
Imagine getting pulled over by a random breath test. I just had a whiskey pie. Yeah, right. Good excuse. That's a beautiful, beautiful cookbook this year. I love it.
What's your favourite one, Ben?
Well, Michael's got the book at the moment, but I really do love the Southern soul food there.
Oh, very good. And what about you, Michael?
It beats that sausage roll we had, Michael, earlier before the show.
I don't know what you're talking about, Ben. Look, I'm a bit of an old classic. I've got to say that raspberry pavlova looks so delicious.
It's a bit of a fave.
Exactly.
This is a bit of a different take on the pavlova. We've made it in two rounds. The pavlova is made in two rounds. And then we've got a fresh, just a litre of ice cream. So it's like a pavlova sandwich.
Yum.
How good is that?
I love that popcorn look,
I know.
Too. What's
and do you know what? That popcorn is so easy. Oh. The recipe's there. Look, it's you know, what is it? It's not even four or five ingredients. But
yeah.
I like the way you've decorated it, Michelle, in little cones to serve.
Oh, that's Hannah, our food stylist. She's done a wonderful job. And yes, the popcorn is very, very easy. And it's a great gift to make. It's a salted caramel popcorn. So it's just a matter of, mounting those ingredients together and putting in your popcorn. And then you've got a perfect gift or just a nice little after-dinner treat.
Now, I've got to come clean. The sticky lemon shortbread actually did come into the office. And honestly, I turned into Hoover Hog. look at it. Look how beautiful that looks.
It is inviting.
Yeah. It was beautiful.
I tell you, we've got a little producer working with us today. He's giving us the wind up. I tell you what, your son is really well trained.
He comes from good stock.
So the issue is out now. Of course, if you go out, you can get the December issue and flip it over, and there's your Mind Food Christmas cookbook on the back there. So that's fantastic.
We've got to get planning underway, everybody. The issue's there. It's beautiful, a really, really beautiful cookbook. So get out there and get yourself organized early and host that Christmas party. You might think you're up to it, but the recipes are easy. And you'll be the star of the day.
Hey, Michelle, thanks for being on the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Tell you what, lots of interesting things taking place in the world of biological farms of Australia. We've got Andrew Monk on the line to tell us a little bit about what that's all about. How are you, Andrew?
Great, Ben. Thank you.
Tell me, what do you do as a job and what's this all about, this whole industry?
Well, I'm a director of Biological Farms of Australia, and every 2 years we commission a report called the Australian Organic Market Report.
Mm-hmm.
And it tracks the trends in our industry from what consumers are doing, where they're buying and what they're buying, through to what's happening at farm gate.
Now tell us, what is the report looking into this time? What revelations can you reveal?
Almost two-thirds, 65% of consumers in Australia said in the past year they consumed something organic. Now, that continues to go up and broaden.
Yep.
And the sort of things they're buying are everything from lifestyle type of products, which might include cosmetics and pet food even, would you believe, through to, you know, your normal staples of fruit and veg, milk and the like.
You are seeing a lot more organic stuff around. I'm seeing it. And is this because people have adopted this whole approach to a healthier lifestyle?
Look, I wouldn't say everyone has, of course, Ben. If we had to be far more than the billion-dollar industry is now, but you know, more than a billion-dollar industry is still a significant industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's developing into an option, an easier option for more consumers who want to know where their food is.
Yeah.
And secondly, an option, I guess, for those who wish to reduce their load of pesticides in the food they consume, or they don't want hormones or antibiotics in their food. Those sorts of things. There's a whole variety of different reasons that people have for consuming organic.
Now, what about meat products? Does that fall into this report as well or not?
Yes. Well, in fact, there's often people, beef and red meat generally has become the biggest single value of the industry now, which surprises some people.
Mm.
Red meat, dairy, and fruit and veg are the three biggest staples, and they're really, because I guess they're becoming more available now on supermarket shelves, more people are actually able to buy them. One of the things we do is we track questions on consumers around what would be your barriers to buying more.
Mm.
And certainly while price is right up there, one-fifth of Australians say price or value is not a problem for them when it comes to organic, but that means four-fifths say price is a bit of a barrier, and
yeah.
organic is more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, they say, my challenge is getting hold of it. It's hard. Now, in the last 2 years, that barrier has come significantly down, and in large measure, it's due to the presence of the big retailers now coming online more, but even also some successful organic retailers that are, you know, positioning themselves well, selling certified organic product. And lastly, there's been the barrier of the question of trust. You know, how do I know it's organic? And there's been an ongoing fundamental shift in consumers' awareness, firstly, of the need to look for certification, with over a third saying they wouldn't even buy a product if it didn't have a certification mark on it. And the words Australian Certified Organic with the, what we call the Bud logo on product is now recognised by more than 3 out of 4 Australians and growing, which means that Australians are beginning to understand what to look for when to buy organic. And under consumer law, they're protected if it's a certified organic product. They certainly aren't if it's just making an amber claim around organic. And luckily, that sort of product that isn't certified is very limited now in the marketplace.
Mm. And look, the other interesting thing is in the cities, you're seeing a lot more of these weekend markets and people doing that organic stuff. And that seems to be becoming a bit of a lifestyle change. You go with your family on a Sunday to the local market. And you know, for some people, that's a whole new experience.
Yeah, look, you're right, Ben. I think, again, it's tapping into this whole question of people wanting to know more about the origin of their food, you know, who farmed it. And then the next logical question from that, you know, all our city folk is, well, then how was it produced? And when people start asking questions around how things were produced, sometimes they're quite mortified to find out some of the things that do or don't go on in producing their food. And we definitely think that that's been the, you know, the solid singular reason why there's this been this growth in organic over the last few years.
I'll tell you what, you've got a very interesting job there, Andrew. Thanks for coming on and talking to us today and giving us an update on that market report. The Director of Biological Farms of Australia, Andrew Monk, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Ben.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Who have we got on the line, Michael?
Well, we've got the very first chef who has been signed to Gourmet Abu Dhabi.
Oh, wow.
I know. That's going to be happening in February.
Yep.
It goes for a couple of weeks, kicks off on the 5th of February in 2013. And it's actually the fifth year. So it's the
how
same.
Fabulous.
I know, same age as Mind Food. But on the show today, we've got the famous and young and talented Japanese chef, Chef Takagi. Hi, how are you?
Very fine. How are you?
Now, you've never been to Abu Dhabi before, have you?
This is my exactly first trip to come to Abu Dhabi.
The ingredients that you use in your cooking, are they very different?
Yes. Basically, in my restaurant, I'm always trying to use local ingredients. But in Abu Dhabi, there's not so many local ingredients, but I'm trying to use what we can get in Abu Dhabi.
So what will you be preparing in February at Gourmet Abu Dhabi? What dishes will you be creating?
Since I came here yesterday, I'm checking many kind of ingredients in the restaurant and the tasting. Then I'm still thinking about what we can prepare in February.
Your restaurant in Japan, how many would it seat every night? How many meals do you do every night?
My main restaurant is we have around 60 seats.
And what's your speciality there?
Yes, it depends on the season. And right now in Japan, we do have a very beautiful snow crab and yellowfin.
So can they expect that in Abu Dhabi in February?
Well, I have never been to Abu Dhabi in February, but I'm still having good communication with the chef in the restaurant. And try to do my best.
Why is it important for Japanese cuisine to be featured in Arabian countries?
In Abu Dhabi, there's not so many Japanese restaurants, so it doesn't mean Japanese food is not so popular yet without sushi. Then I would like to show to the Arabian people Japanese food, Japanese cuisine is not only sushi but also other things.
Now, your restaurant is in Japan's northwest coast of Japan. So is there a lot of seafood on the menu?
Yes, because my hometown is in Kanazawa. It's located in Japan Sea. So that's why we can get very fresh fish from Japan Sea. And also, we do have a beautiful mountainside.
Mm.
So that's why, especially in autumn, we can get some fresh mushroom, wild mushrooms and wild vegetables from the mountainside.
And tell me, how are you coping with the heat in Abu Dhabi? Because it gets very hot.
Well, that's why I came here to think about that. I have not, I cannot find the answer yet.
Tell me,
maybe in airplane to going back to Japan, I will think about that.
Well, I guess after you've been there for a few days, you'll get lots of inspiration for Gourmet Abu Dhabi, which of course is going to be in February, Ben.
Fantastic.
I think kicks off on the 5th and goes through to the 20th. So
it's an amazing event, and it's great to be part of.
That's right. So listen, thanks, Chef Takagi. It's great to have you on the show, and we'll see you in February.
Yes, thank you so much. It's nice talking to you.
Thank you, you too.
Well, that's another edition of Mind Food Radio.
It sure is. Now, how many have we done? It feels, sitting across the desk from you, honestly. How long has it been?
Well, the hypochondria is at least 135.
Look, I have to be honest. I think you have been fixed with that. I think
I have. You know, all these interviews that we do, it's funny. It's almost like counselling for us as well. You know, some people say it's quite confronting, a lot of the stuff. And I said, yeah, but that's called life.
Look, could we get a couple of sofas in here? We can just lay back. Now, talk to me, doctor. Talk to me. No, so, I think you're right. I think just that whole mix of different interviews, particularly, you know, the health and psychology, it's interesting stuff.
Thanks for joining us today. And, Michael, what are you doing this week?
Another barbecue.
I'll bring the salad.
Okay.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick K. Roos. Bogart Torelli speaking.